This is a Collider.com audio interview.
Yes, we're doing Underworld 4, continuation of the Underworld series. First two had Kate Beckinsale top landing. The third one was a prequel prior to her involvement in the series. We are now coming back to picking up after the second one, except we are 12 to 15 years in the future.
Are you guys envisioning, I mean, this is a little bit ahead, but how much, the franchise is very successful. Mm-hmm. How much have you reached a point now where you're taking it one picture at a time, or are you in the back of your brain thinking, well, Kate's back for this one, you know, we're setting up for future?
Once you're doing number four, you can't stop thinking about maybe there will be a number five. As of now, the number five has not been greenlit. There's no script. There's no approved story. I think if we were to do it, we would have a pretty good idea of who the characters would be and what the basic timeline would be. It would take place after number four. But there are a lot of different variables that would have to be worked out. Kate would have to agree to come back. She didn't want to do the third one, so the fourth one was a return for her. I shouldn't say she didn't want to do one. She didn't do the third one. And she would have to agree to do a fifth one. For any actors, doing the same role over and over again is not always the most attractive thing. Kate, you'll have to talk to her and get her own reaction for that. But it's not the most immediately and obviously attractive thing for an actor to play a role multiple times. But this is still an iconic role. I think that she inhabits the movie, and it's impossible to imagine what this series of films would have been like without her.
So what kind of things are rolling on this one? Because obviously there's a lot of parts. I mean, Len has been obviously involved from the beginning.
Yeah.
You've been involved from the beginning. Kate, I mean, what actually got these going? Did someone have an idea for a fourth movie, and then you kind of like pitched it around?
Len and Kate are married, as you know. And so we're not always privy to what goes on in the Weissman Beckinsale household. But Len basically came up with the general idea, and we got the original script for the final idea last, what was that, December of 2009. Mm-hmm. While the basic story was good, the idea, how much of the plot are we?
This is all embargoed till future notice.
So we can be somewhat blunt.
Yeah.
The idea that it's 15 years in the future, that the Kate Beckinsale's character has been in cryogenic suspension for 15 years, and that she wakes up in a future world that where the existence of vampires and werewolves has been made known to the humans. There's been a counterattack. There's been a genocide and a purge to try and remove all the vampires and werewolves from the face of the earth. And there has been a company that has taken the forefront of testing people because both vampires and werewolves can appear in almost human form. A company has evolved or has come to power, so to speak, because of their role in being able to test whether or not people are vampires or werewolves. That company has become pretty much all-powerful. It's a biotech company that has amassed enormous political power, and they are the company that has been holding her for 15 years. So the film, there's a prologue that explains all of what we've just gone through for the first 10 minutes of the movie, and then there's a cut to black, and then now we're 15 years later. And for us in the movie, and for the character, Celine, there's been no missing time at all, but she realizes as she goes through as she breaks out of the confinement that she's in, she gets back out into the world, and as she goes through the world and starts picking up clues, wait a minute, this is not the time that I thought it was. It's 15 years in the future, and this one location that the last thing that she remembers was at this one location. She goes back to the location and it's completely different now, and she starts to put together that she's somehow been confined, and for a reason, she's not sure why. So there's a lot of the film is actually structured as a mystery. Okay. She's trying to piece together what happened, who did this to her, and why.
Before, just a follow up. I always got the impression the first movie was already in the future. Is that not the case? Was it kind of?
Well, we've been very careful not to mix time cues. Mm-hmm. The first film was shot in Budapest, and the architecture of Budapest goes back to, in some cases, to the Middle Ages, and it's a parallel universe. It's not a specific time in a specific place. And we've always been very careful with the things that most often signify time periods in filmmaking are cars, hairstyles, and wardrobe, and sometimes diction, the way that people talk. And we've been very, very careful to mix those up constantly. And especially if you have creatures who have lived for hundreds of years, or in some cases thousands of years, they would be all mixed up. The type of clothes that they wear, the diction that they use, their being, their demeanor, wouldn't be recognizable in any given period. So we've always been very, very careful to not give too much of a cue. And in this particular film, there are futuristic elements. Some of the weapons are very futuristic. Of course, the weaponry that you have to use to take down a vampire or take down a werewolf is different. You have to use UV bullets for a vampire and silver bullets for lichen. But the design of the weapons is different. In fact, that's a big part of the Underworld franchise, has always been weaponry design. Not just guns, but swords and knives and silver whips and the various other things that we've done.
Why these directors?
They did a film called Storm about, when did that come out? 4 years ago?
Yeah, about 4 years.
They're a pair of Swedes. One of them is more the writer, and one of them is more the editor, and then they co-direct. They have a very unusual style of working, which frankly takes some getting used to. They alternate days. One will direct one day, and then he sits back while the other one directs the other day. I've never heard of this before. I didn't think it was going to work. It sure is confusing. I mean, but the way that you extract magic out of people's minds, it's not logical. It's not rational. And sometimes you have to put up with stuff that just drives you completely crazy in order to get that magical essence out of them. And
if I could just sort of mm-hmm. ask you a follow-up. If you're doing a big action set piece that takes place over multiple days, does that mean that one of them is, they're switching off each day, but you're in the middle of filming one scene?
We've only had a couple of times that we had a scene where it really made sense for the person who directed the first part to direct the second part. And when we've done that, the same guy has done both days. But most of the scenes that we've done haven't been bigger than 2 days. And this has been a question. I mean, as much as they've worked this way for 10 years together, they've known each other since I think they were 12. They've been friends their whole lives. They're both, I think, what are they, 40, 38,
just
something like
that?
So they've known each other for 30 years, and they've been working together as a directing pair for, I think, 12 years. They'll tell you that themselves. They have a... To them, this is normal. But even to them, they're still figuring out how to do this. I mean, that's the whole process of filmmaking, is that almost never, I've made 50 films, and almost never have you done the same thing from one film to the next. You're always coming to work and solving problems that you haven't had to solve before. And as a result of that, you get better at it. It being in a situation where you don't quite understand, where you don't quite have a clear picture at the beginning how you're going to get to the end, and you just work your way through it. And this is no exception. But working with the two directors who have a style of working together which is completely different than any other directing team I've ever worked with, it is an adjustment, and it's a constant learning process.
To your perception, how is the cast and crew adapting to that?
It's confusing. Filmmaking is in its best form is a benign dictatorship. There's the person in charge is the person in charge, and every creative decision is rooted through that one person. Whether or not the director of a film is an auteur in the classic sense of understanding everything and being able to paint the entire film with his own personal paintbrush. The filmmaking system of today has evolved to treat the director as that person through whom everything has to go. And we have a much more devolved process than that.
Right.
And it is confusing. It takes, I can't tell you the number of times where the prop person has come up to one of the directors and said, yeah, well, we got this, and he's, no, I'm not directing you. You have to go talk to the other guy about that.
So to follow up, they're pretty clear cut. Like, this is your area, this is my area. At least they understand.
It's not areas, it's days. It's literally days. I've worked with directing teams before, with Mark Neveldine and Brian Taylor, who did the Crank films. I've worked I've done this before. It's still different. Because it is literally a time thing. It's like the one punches in and the other punches out, and it's weird. And over time, you start to recognize that there's differences between them, where one of them is really a little bit better at the writing part, or is the one that naturally assumes the writing part. If you're rewriting a scene, or you suddenly realize, oh God, this scene was written this way, but then this doesn't work, and then what are we going to do? There's one that's really handles that, and then the other one is really more the one that is primarily the editor. In fact, Bjorn is the editor, more the editor, cut a piece out of the first 3 weeks of shooting that was really great. I mean, the guy really can do it.
Do they really like to keep the cast and crew guessing as to which one's directing at a given time? Does it ever become like dead ringers?
No. I think that they, I don't want to speculate as to what's going on in their brain. I think that they somewhat enjoy the aspect that they have an unusual working process that everybody else is not as up to speed on as they are. Who wouldn't? I mean, it's fun to be the guys that have done it different and actually be the ones getting away with it. The filmmaking is so complicated and so difficult that you can't deliberately confuse people, or you'll be in big trouble.
What is their stated reasoning behind directing that way or working that way, like taking one day off?
Two heads are better than one. I think that's their thinking. They're very close. They're also, I don't want to get too speculative about this, but they're Swedish, and in Sweden's is probably the most socialist country in the world. And the responsibility and the value of the individual is necessarily diluted somewhat, I think, by that cultural milieu that they grew up in. They are very collaborative. They're actually, I have to say, they're as collaborative or more collaborative than any other director I've ever seen. They're not precious about, no, this was our idea and we're going to do it our way. They've actually been really good and really adaptable. This show has been a very difficult show. They're all difficult. There's no such thing as an easy movie. This one has still been unusually complicated. They have shown themselves to be very, very adaptable. So we look at this as though it's sort of unusual and scratch our heads and, oh, this is weird. But in some ways, it's actually really been helpful and good for us that they've been able to be so adaptive. The other thing that having two directors does is directing is incredibly stressful. Every single thing all day is going through your head, and it's very, very hard to keep a clear picture of where you are in the script and whether she should be more upset here, less upset. And when you're every other day you're taking a day off, it really helps you keep a clear head all the way through. So I wouldn't recommend this for everybody as a way to do every movie, but there is certainly a value to it. There's no question.
I want to ask about the rest of the crew, because I mean, obviously you've had three other movies. Mm-hmm. After Topless was regular mm-hmm. between them. Mm-hmm. You only have one person, as far as I can tell, from the other movies, James, the VFX guy.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the reason for like getting new people on? Did you try to get some of the same people back, or?
Well, Patrick was not available. He was going to go off and do another film. Patrick is. It has been a huge part of everything, but he's still involved in the film, and so is Len. Len wrote the original story, and has, as we've been rewriting there have been a number of occasions over the last 6 or 8 weeks where we've had to rewrite scenes, and Len's rewritten all of them, even though he's directing another movie.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I can't even believe that guy must never sleep, but we'll call him at 11 o'clock at night and say, oh, God, we've got this problem. We're shooting tomorrow. We have this. What are we going to do? And at 7 o'clock in the morning, you look in your email, and there will be the scene. Okay. And so Len is very, very much a part of the process. We have a daily system called Pix, which a lot of people use now, which effectively puts your dailies onto a server, and people with passwords can log in and watch your dailies. And invariably, the first person to comment on all the dailies that we've shot is Len. So he's very, very much the godfather of the not just the franchise, but this film as well.
What about everyone else, the DP? Are you going for a different look with this movie? Is it going to be very, very different from the
other? This film is different than the others in that it's 3D. We've had a different DP on every single movie. The first film was shot on film, and it was we did a digital DI. And the first DP was Tony Pierce Roberts, who was a Merchant Ivory guy, did Howard Zinn, did Room with a View, all these very sumptuous boudoir movies. Mm-hmm. And he was chosen because of that. We wanted somebody that knew how to light a period-looking film, because we set out to make a period film, even though it really wasn't. And the second film was shot by Simon Dugan, a DP who had shot... Did he do Alex Poirier's film? I'm blanking on...
Dark City.
Yes, thank you. He had shot Dark City. So he, which Patrick Tatopoulos had been the production designer on. So Patrick, when Tony Pierce Roberts, I think Tony Pierce Roberts had did his genre film and then was ready to go back to doing the English, you know, the normal type of Academy Award type film. It was also the first film was also very difficult. It was all nights, 6 day weeks. And we shot for 12 weeks. It was just a grind. Mm-hmm. And so in the second film, we went with Patrick Dugan, who had worked with Alex Proyas, Simon Dugan, I mean. And then on the third film we shot in New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
And we've been all over the place, globetrotting with this film. But New Zealand is where you go when you want to shoot a medieval movie. They do it better than anybody. And... the DP that was actually another Australian, Ross Emery, shot the third one. This film is 3D, and it's pretty much impossible to shoot 3D on film. And you really don't want to be learning how to shoot 3D, not just the compositionally, but technically. You don't want to be learning that while you're shooting the movie. So we wanted to hire a DP who had shot 3D before, and there's not a long list. And Scott Keevan, who is the DP of this film, had done another film with Lakeshore, with our company, previously, which was a completely different film. But in the so we knew him and liked him, and then he had just shot The Darkest Hour, film that was shot in Russia, in 3D. So he seemed to be the best choice for this particular film, and it turned out we were right. The film looks fantastic. We are using cameras which we only got them. There's a company called Red that makes very, very high definition, high resolution digital cameras. There's this new camera called the Epic, the Red Epic, and the camera itself is this big. It's tiny. When you go up onto the set, you'll see them. The camera looks gigantic, but the actual cameras themselves, there's two, because there's one for the left eye, one for the right eye. The actual cameras are this big, and there's a whole buttload of gack around it that makes it, the whole rig look huge, but the actual cameras are tiny. And the Lord of the Rings is shooting with them, and Spider-Man, the current Spider-Man, is shooting with them, and this film. So we were the first three films to get these cameras, which just became available. And I'm pretty sure that we will be the first in the theaters with them. But it's a new camera in 3D. There's an enormous amount of technical stuff. We shot 5 weeks of tests with these cameras, which normally you have 1 day of testing. We shot 5 weeks of testing to make sure that we knew exactly what the technical tolerances of the cameras were, how robust they would be, how they work out in rain and in difficult conditions. So, and the choice of DP was motivated more by practical considerations than by should we keep shooting all the films with the same DP.
I think Cameron bought, or Peter Jackson bought 50 of these cameras.
Yeah, he did.
How many do you guys have on set?
8. But Peter Jackson is also is a technophile.
Yeah.
I think just the idea of having 50 and having everybody know that he is 50 is attractive to him. And the cameras themselves are actually not that expensive. Each camera, these Epics, is about $60,000 just for the camera itself. But you need gobs of GAC to for them to work in a 3D context. The rigs, there's two main competitors that make the 3D rigs. There's Element Technica, and those are the rigs that we're using, and there's the 3Ality rigs, which are very, very complicated and prone to... They're delicate. There are constantly issues with the cameras. Having said that, it's not nearly as bad as I had been told it would be. We actually haven't really lost that much time to 3D. But it is a much more complicated way to shoot a movie.
Can you talk a little bit about when did you guys first know you were going to do 3D, and how, if at all, did the script change?
We knew from the beginning. That was one of the conditions for making the film, was that Sony, the studio that's the main financier and the main distributor of the film, is because they're Sony, which is an electronics manufacturer, has a vested interest in 3D. They've put their entire weight behind 3D, and I think pretty much everything Sony's shooting now, certainly all the tentpoles, are all 3D. And so it was never a question. We were going to be shooting a 3D movie. This was not the first film that we, the Lakeshore, the production company, had considered doing in 3D. It's the first one that actually got green lit. But we had thought of doing this, and we all wanted to do it. It's a challenge, and we're all kind of geeks at Lakeshore anyway. So the idea that we'd get to play with some new stuff was really attractive to us. So there was never a question of doing it any other way.
Well, how did the script... Is this one of these films where it's going to be... like gimmicky 3D, or is it going to be more like 3D's enhancing the story, or are there just certain moments that are going to be like coming out at you?
Okay, there's only one way I can answer that question. Well, of course, it's going to be organic to the story. James Cameron, in his basically created an entire 3D vocabulary for Avatar, which was very successful and which was different from a lot of the other films that had been shot in 3D previously. It's a understated and somewhat conservative approach. I'm sure you're all familiar with how 3D actually works. The fact that you have two cameras, usually they're shot, one is like this and one is like this, because you're shooting through a half-silvered mirror, which you have to do in order to get the lenses close enough to each other to get a stereoscopic vision that actually mimics the human eye. And you can't put two cameras side by side next to each other and get the lenses close. So that's why you see this half-silvered mirror. But just for the sake of argument, let's just assume that we're shooting parallel, which sometimes you do. The more you converge the cameras, that is the point at which a line drawn through the very center of the lens extending out to infinity, at the point that those lines cross is called the convergence. And the convergence point, when seen on screen, appears at the distance from your eye of the screen itself. And everything behind that convergence point, everything past where the convergence point is, will appear to be behind the screen, and everything before that convergence point will appear to be in front of the screen. But we realized very quickly over time, David Coatsworth, my fellow producer, we realized very quickly over time, not just us, everybody realized that the more stuff you had in front of the convergence point coming out into the audience, the more eye strain you had and the more fatigue you have, because your eyes can't resolve an object that's too far out in front of the convergence point and still be able to see what's behind it. So Cameron started this whole vocabulary of putting almost everything behind the screen, so to speak. And we're sticking most closely to that, although there are moments or things that come out into the audience. There'll be projectiles and things like that. You have to have a few of those moments. But we're looking at 3D not as a gimmick of distracting the audience as often as possible with hyper dimensionality, and more as an organic part of actually telling a story and immersing the viewer in an environment the same way that other films do, but with an additional dimension, so to speak.
Richard, I think David needs
just borrowing for one of
the... Oh, I thought you were coming in for your interview.